And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus. We're streaming live at kuci.org and we're on iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, August 29th, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today for the entire hour is Glenn David Gold. Glenn is the author of the novels Sunnyside and Carter Beats the Devil, which have been translated into 14 languages. His short stories and essays have appeared in McSweeney's, Playboy, and the New York Times Magazine. He lives in L.A., and he's here today to primarily talk about his memoir, I Will Be Complete. Hey, Glenn.
Howdy.
Hi. Good to have you on the show.
Yes, it's lovely to be speaking at 9 o'clock in the morning. Usually I'm just sort of hunched over a computer muttering to myself, so it's nice to mutter to the world.
Well, but I'm glad you're here to mutter to us, because I have a lot to talk about, a lot to ask you.
All right.
You were in the MFA program here, yeah?
Yes, I was, yeah.
So talk about that a little bit for any sort of UCI anteaters listening.
Okay. Well, this is probably going to be ancient history for folks. But I applied and got into the program in 1995, class of 98. It took 3 years to get through. It was the transformative learning experience of my life, to tell you the truth. I don't know what's helpful to hear and what's not, but I can just talk, and at some point you can try to stop me if you're up for it.
That's fine.
But I happened to get into a completely spectacular class. It was one of those experiences where I was working a desk job. I was the worst possible employee you would want to have doing office support for a nonprofit. I was the guy with, you know, four bad unpublished novels in my desk drawer. And I was kind of skirting the edge of bitterness in my early 30s about not making any more progress in my ability to write. And I had applied with the hopes that it was going to give me, you know, 2 years of solid time of writing. And it gave me that, and it also gave me a room full of really good readers who were also excellent critics who helped me write my first novel.
Hmm. How do you think your writing life would have gone had you not gone into this MFA program or any MFA program?
Well, that's one of the weirder forks in the road, is that the same week I got into the program, I also got hired on as a staff writer on a Nickelodeon animated show.
Mm.
And I had to make a decision about which pathway to choose. And it ended up becoming easy for me because I got hired and fired twice in 1 week. And I would pitch ideas and they'd get shot down by the producer's nephew and things like that. And what I learned is that in TV, especially at the time, it was very, very hard to move any ideas forward. And in fiction writing, you know, if you finished a project you had and your agent liked it, your editor liked it, sales and marketing liked it, you were basically free to go out on onto the into the world. And that struck me as being a better deal.
Mm-hmm.
So had I not gotten to the MFA program, I would have pursued screenwriting and probably would have been really bitter.
As opposed to just a little bitter.
Well, just a normal amount of bitterness that,
we
all have. Yeah, the average, you know, the average driving on the freeway bitterness rather than, anything Barton Fink-like.
Okay, well, that's kind of interesting. That's really interesting, actually, because, there, you know, these days there are so many MFA programs. And, you know, just about every writer or writing student that I have is always contemplating whether to do it or not. And it seems to be an ongoing question. And as the MFA programs proliferate, one wonders, you know.
Yeah, and I understand. I mean, there's definitely pros and cons to it. And it's your mileage may vary. I teach sometimes up at the Squaw Valley community of writers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a 1 week program where people from all walks of life come in and get a chance to be treated seriously as writers for a week. And it's sort of like it's an intense week that's sort of like an MFA program. MFA introduction, MFA light. You know, it's like the it's the trial. It's the type of thing you get when you're like, you know, subscribe to the Times online, you get to your 10 free articles. It's like that, you know. I always have that conversation with people about whether they should commit to an MFA program. And it really depends on where you are in your work and your career. And then also something that can't be judged in advance is who the other people in the room are going to be. Because that made all the difference for me. I happened to be in a program where Jeffrey Wolf and Judith Grossman were running it, and they were deeply committed to the idea that they weren't going to change anybody's writing into some sort of standard format, but each book was going to be its own weird self, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so finding that program and somehow knowing that that's what you're going into, yeah, it's tricky, huh?
Yeah. Well, I guess so, but I, you know, I followed my instincts there, and I was, you really, I think that anybody who's contemplating it should just try to talk to the students who are currently there and, you know, see what it's like.
Mm. Yeah, I was at SQUAW in the early 90s, and I wish I had a do-over, because I sort of wasted some of that time on a guy, you know. It's like I should have just gone to all the workshops, just everything, and you know. Anyway, so don't waste your time on a guy if you go.
Yeah, well, that's a common story that happens too. Yeah,
but it was great being up there. I loved it. So yeah. So let's talk about I Will Be Complete, published by Knopf. Talk about how the memoir came about.
I have most of my life realized that I've had an unusual life, and I had originally tried to write it as fiction, but every time I did it, it seemed to be satire or unbelievable. No teachers bought it in the sense of believing that anything like that could happen to a character in fiction. So I didn't try to turn it into a memoir for a very long time, because I had the idea that I was in my 20s, I didn't really understand. I felt that memoir was an admission of failure. If you couldn't do the transformative thing of turning into fiction, that somehow you weren't really working hard enough. And it really wasn't, here's a happy coincidence to talk about this. It really wasn't until I got into the MFA program at UCI that I understood that I was completely wrong. Jeffrey... who was coming in that year to run the program, he had written an unbelievably good memoir called The Duke of Deception, which couldn't have been told in any way other than as memoir. There's no way he could have fictionalized the story, because he was trying to, it's probably a better word than reconstruct, but that's what I've got right now, reconstruct the life of his father, who was a con man. And so he was trying to get at that gossamer thin layer of truth that runs through things, and like presented it at every different angle, and it's a wonderful story, really thought provoking, really challenging, and it's just by definition couldn't have been fiction. And he led a memoir writing class. Actually, it was a memoir class. We read like six memoirs, and he led us through the idea of memoir as art form, and we all had to write our own pieces of memoir for the class, and I ended up writing about 20 or 30 pages of my own story for that class. And that's the beginning of trying to come to terms with my own life story. It took me another 20 years after that, to get to the next pages of the memoir.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting, because in terms of age, because before we came on, a DJ here at the station, when I told him you were coming on the show, he asked me how old a writer should be before they write a memoir. How would you react to that question then?
Again, it's like applying to an MFA program. Your mileage may vary. I think the bigger issue is how much life you've lived, but it really is how much distance you've had from the experience, and whether you've had time to process it so that the events you're discussing are cold, if the word cold makes sense. I, would say that, you know, I was lucky in that I had a lot of therapy and I had a lot of time to contemplate what my story meant. You know, I took a first whack at this when I was in my early 30s and, you know, did okay with it. But as far as the extended memoir, I couldn't have written it any earlier than now. I'm 54.
So processing, you know, the experience is a big part of being ready.
Yeah, don't you think so?
Yeah. Oh, no, I definitely think so. If you're in it, I don't know. It's how do you see it if you're still in it?
Yeah, and you can tell when you're reading work that hasn't been. You can tell when the writer hasn't settled it yet. You can tell when there's stuff that's still tugging on them and they don't quite have the perspective yet. And there's no shame in that. It's just a few extra layers of thought need to go into it.
So then, you know, one of my questions was, and you sort of answered it because you've written parts of this throughout the last 20 years or so, but how do you write with such detail then about such a long time ago, especially say if you were coming at this cold, say you were starting now, you hadn't tried years ago, you didn't have pieces of it from years ago. How would you do that?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I mean, is it a memory thing that you just have the photographic memory or emotional memory that you remember scenes, you remember what people said?
Oh, no, I mean, I have journals.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I've kept journals since I was 17. Hmm. And so there's a lot of that. And then also, I do have a really good memory. Especially when I was younger. It's funny, like, more recently, as my girlfriend points out, she remembers all kinds of things about, you know, the last 6 years we've been together that I don't. And I actually look upon that not as a problem, but as a triumph, because I remembered everything as a kid because I had to. Mm-hmm. It was a defense mechanism because I was growing up in a kind of chaos, and I would just say that just the horizon line kept moving as far as what was true and what wasn't. So I had to keep it straight in my own head.
Mm. Yeah. Well, early on in the book, you talk about you talk throughout about growing up in various situations, but, you know, as a kid, you grew up in such an anxiety-producing, wealthy household. You know, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. The early pages here were kind of interesting, too, because you lived in Corona del Mar, which is where I live now, and I kept meaning to ride by that address, you know?
Oh,
it's like, okay,
yeah.
I got to ride by that house. I haven't, but...
Yeah, you can't really see much. It's a ranch house. It's flat. It's on a hillside. I don't think there's really a lot to take in there. My father... pioneered the use of cassette tapes in America in the late 1960s, changed America from reel to reel to cassette. And he made a whole bunch of money one day when he and his company signed up the number one band in America, Herb Alpert, the Tijuana Brass, to their cassettes. And then all that collapsed because it turned out the cassette didn't work that well. But in between, for about 5 years, we lived in Corona del Mar in Harborview Hills, across from Fashion Island. Mm-hmm. And it was an extravagant life of plenty. And my dad loved it, and it made my mother, who had grown up in extreme poverty, very anxious about the situation because she felt that money was not the answer to things and couldn't save you. So it put a bit of tension in the relationship.
This would be a great time to hear you read. Could you do that?
Yeah, sure. In fact, I can read a couple minutes from the very beginning here.
Good.
Close to the beginning.
Okay.
Okay. This is from early section of the book here. And I might just take 1 minute here. I'm going to have a sip of water and
And if you just tuned in, I'll take a minute to say you're listening to Writers on Writing. And my guest for the entire hour is Glenn David Gold. We're talking about his memoir, I Will Be Complete.
I know some facts, but they don't make my mother any less of a mystery. She grew up in London during the war. She told me that bombs sometimes fell on her playground. She married an American GI, moved to Hollywood, divorced him, and met my father. When I was little, she talked about her first husband as if he'd been a tree branch falling on a path, something she'd gotten around so she could be free to meet my dad. She told the stories of more recent times with leisure and nuance. It was as if everything that had happened in England was marked by fog and switchback trails overgrown with nettles. Everything in America was easily mapped, obstacles met and overcome, culminating, she wanted me to know, in my birth. You were wanted, she said often. I grew up in Corona del Mar, south of Los Angeles, in a house that faced the sunsets. I can't imagine how different it was for my mother from her childhood. She didn't fit in. She looked like she should, long blonde hair, slender body, kind blue eyes, skin that tanned easily. But she was German blonde, European stock, a stranger here, something her body knew well. She was a little deaf, and when she didn't understand what someone said, she looked at them with a curiosity that made her seem alien. She had a modest two-piece swimsuit of pale blue, insulated with many layers of material between its exterior where it touched her body. Its bottom piece reached above her navel, the better to cover a mysterious curved scar on her back that when I was very young I would touch with my fingertips to try to understand the different ways skin could feel. When she herself was 4 years old, she'd been in the hospital for many months. No one had told her why. When she came to the United States, a doctor saw the scar and asked her why she'd had a kidney removed. She didn't know she was missing a kidney. How disconcerting it must have been to hold in her mind both her gothic childhood and her present life of coastal breezes, sunglasses, money in the bank, her own swimming pool, going barefoot at cocktail parties, how even in wintertime her friends would pick fruit from their backyards, make bowls of sangria, and greet her at their front doors with a happy Mikasa es su casa. Because it was Southern California, we took long drives almost every day. I learned that when we went by a pasture, if you relaxed your eyes and let the fence posts rush by, the tiny flickers of the sights beyond would resolve into glimpses of the farm. That's what it was like with my mother's past life. She sewed clothing for me. She made me tuna melts for lunch. When I couldn't sleep, she sat on my bed and sang Moon River. She read up on ESP and decided she and I had it. I used to lie in my bed and try to send out brainwaves to my mother. SOS. Sometimes on a different day, she would come into my room and ask if I'd just been calling her. And I always said yes, and she would nod significantly, admitting to a seasonal wind only she and I knew about. Good.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. That was Glenn David Gold reading from I Will Be Complete. As you were reading, I was wondering if, as you're writing, do you read aloud?
All the time, yeah. It's every, pretty much, it's part of the drafting process. Every morning I try to read aloud what I wrote the day before.
What does that do? What does that do for you? And why do you do it?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons for it, but I think it has to do with defining the voice of the book and understanding what's awkward. I mean, just on a, you know, on the initial level, it's eliminating grammatical mistakes and figuring out what the flow is like. But then when I was writing this particular book also, I did a couple of really terrible drafts that just did not work, and I had to throw out almost everything. And when I did, the way I kind of came back from that was I signed up for open mic nights and, reading for 5 minutes aloud at bars and things. And I would, that in the afternoon before the reading, I would sit down and write all new stuff and read it aloud to see how it came across to people. And there's something about room tone. There's something about listening to how the audience reacts to the words as they're kind of loud that really made me understand how to write this book.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I can't remember any other writer on the show talking about reading at open mics. And that is such a great idea because, yeah, you get the reaction right away. It's not somebody mm-hmm. reading the page and saying, you know, what works or what doesn't work. You're feeling what's working yeah. and what's not working.
Yeah, I tried at one point when I was a few years ago. I was interested in doing a reading series where it would just be established novelists reading aloud what they had written that day. Mm-hmm. And I got zero interest from anybody else. Everyone else was horrified by the idea.
I think it's great. I think it's a great idea.
Well, it all depends on what your process is.
Yeah, yeah, I guess. But anyway, I like the idea of getting that immediate reaction. But, you know, I was curious as I was reading if the focus of the book, if you went into the memoir knowing what the focus was and if it changed as you wrote it. I mean, your mother and Peter Charming are really important threads throughout the book. And I wondered if that was always the case.
Good question. Thing is, you know, I didn't know what the book was going to be when I realized I wanted to write a memoir. I have had, like I say, a weird life, and I know that I at first had pegged it as like 7 different volumes I could write, and I pared it down to 3. So this book is 3 volumes, and that's all I really needed. And once I knew what the through line was going to be, you know, what I wanted to talk about is how I ended up emotionally where I'm at. And it turned out that my relationship with my mother was the through line for that. And I always knew that was going to be important, but I don't think I knew that was going to be the focus until I was actually sitting down and writing it.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning of a chapter, I think it's called Christmas, you write, "If I'm a writer, you'd think I might know what it means that my mother is an unreliable narrator, but I really don't. I believe that every story she tells me, every version of it." And then later in that chapter, you say, "Normally when I write, I feel triumphant or cocky or embarrassed or twisting in the wind and anxious to try and rewrite it. With the story of my mother, it was looking through water." I love that. Could you embellish a bit? I mean, just in terms of, you know, writing about someone so close to you and trying to figure that person out while you're trying to figure yourself out?
Yeah, well, I feel like there's those two quotations. They're related, but they came from different places. The second one first is that it took me a while to realize how writing memoir should feel, because, like I say, when I write fiction, I've got a feeling of, yeah, I did that right, you know, I'm high five or looking for some response from an audience in this, in that case. And in this, the feeling is much more different. It's more quotidian. I don't know. It's more you know, after a workout at the gym or something like that, where you just like log the hours, and that turns out to be it. And it's because, you know, it's being obedient to the truth rather than to making up a good story. And so that's where that comes from. And then as far as like, and then writing about people that I know well, that's hard and takes multiple drafts. My early drafts didn't work at all, not just because I didn't get other people right, but because I didn't get myself right. It's a great book. Unfortunately, okay, two words. It's the situation in the story or the story in the situation. I think it's the situation in the story.
Vivian Gornick.
Yeah, Vivian Gornick's book that was that changed the whole direction of this memoir. I initially thought that the idea was for myself to be like a floating eye over everything in which I made no judgments and let the reader decide and all that stuff. And that's good for journalism, but it doesn't work well for memoir because it turns out that the reader wants a main character to experience those transgressive emotions for them, so they know which way to turn and which way the story is going. And I resisted that for a long time, but it turned out to be exactly the right choice, so I had to make myself a completely subjective character in it, so you'd know. I think that being able to make myself as much of a jerk as I am in real life was liberating. if I don't ask anybody to actually like me, it frees up a lot of other narrative judgments in a way. Going from there to writing, once I did that, made myself a character, I understood that I was also going to be trying to make people I knew into characters. And that was a little bit easier. Everybody has nuance behind them. Everybody has... I kept on thinking, how do you describe a character who is like 60% one way, 30% another, and 10% completely unknowable? Mm-hmm. And I realized that a reader already knows that. They get it. You're not giving somebody every little back and forth about them, unless the whole book is about that, every little back and forth, and you're really trying to analyze it to the core. I was influenced a lot by I can never pronounce his name, but it's James Gleick, the guy who wrote the Chaos book years and years ago, which talking about how when you're dealing with chaos and fractals, that the more you get deeper and deeper and deeper into the fractals all the way down to the subatomic level, they're always chaotic and they're always unpredictable. And that made me understand that if you're describing a character either in the macro or the micro, they're always going to have that unpredictability behind them. And that's not something you have to account for every single moment.
Mm. That's great. That, this what you've just been talking about is sort of a mini lecture on memoir writing that everybody needs to hear. So we're going to take a short break, let it sink in, and we'll be right back with more Glenn David Gold. Please stay with us.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, ooh, turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue. Oh, 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 I can't, oh, I can't, oh, I can't forget you. My whole world turns misty blue. Oh, 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 my love, my whole world turns misty blue. Baby, 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 I can't forget you.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus, streaming live on KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We've been here with Glenn David Gold, and before we bring him back on, I want to tell you about an event happening September 18th. At the Lido Village Bookstore, Mark Sarvis and Victoria Patterson will be there. If you want to know more, go to my website, penonfire.com. Let's bring Glenn back on. Hey there.
Hey there. Sounds like a cool event.
It is a cool event. We got to get you down here.
Okay. That was easy.
See? Yeah, that was easy. I'm going to be emailing you later. But before the break, you talked about and you've said a couple of times, actually, that early drafts of I Will Be Complete didn't work. And I was curious whether that was according to you or readers, or how did you know it didn't work?
Who is that according to?
Well, yeah, because, you know, often is it that we're bored by what we're writing, or is it that it's not working, right?
Oh, not we're oh, my Lord, not working. I've told the story a couple of times, so apologies if maybe you've heard it somewhere. However, when as I say, what you've got here, I Will Be Complete, is three separate volumes. There's one part about, basically up to me, about age 12, age 19, age 26. I'd written the first third of it up until I was about 12. I gave it to my agent, and my agent called me back with notes. She gave me 45 minutes worth of notes, and afterwards asked me if I had any questions. And I did. I looked over her notes, and I said, yeah, was there anything you liked? Mm. And she said, honey, don't ever change your font.
Oh, gosh.
So it succeeded on no levels. She was right. I gave it to a couple friends who all agreed. They said, bury this thing. Never, don't write it. It's not worth it. And one of the issues that, well, I mean, here, this is a spoiler, I guess. Now it's a spoiler. It would not be a spoiler in the draft. I wrote the draft chronologically at first, and the book seems chronological, but I leave out a key detail, which is that I was in psychoanalysis from age 4.5 to 9, living in Newport Beach, and I tried to account for that in the beginning. And the problem with that is that it made it sound as if I was a lab rat. There was no way for most people to identify with that experience. It was like saying, yeah, I was born on Mars, but I'm just like you humans. And it just made an alienating experience for people to read. And I didn't know that. I didn't understand it. And it took me a while to figure out that what I should do is put that close to the end of the book, which is where it ends up, where you don't have that as a filter before you get to the rest of me as a character.
Yeah. So, you know, I wonder if the memoir feels and reads so honestly because of that, all that time in psychoanalysis. What do you think? I mean, did that
help?
Yeah.
I've got very mixed, complex muddy feelings about the relationship of therapy, early therapy, and how I'm able to both live my life and experience my life. But I did get a vocabulary very early on, basic Freudian terminology that I had, could parrot at least when I was 5 and 6 and 7 years old, understanding transference and all that other stuff. So I think that might have influenced the idea that there's a subtext to everything before I even knew what a subtext was.
Mm-hmm.
And so that could very well have a relationship to how I write about it.
Mm. So when things fell apart with the cassette tapes, eventually your mother and father separated, divorced, you moved to San Francisco. And for a great part of time as a kid, you lived alone and pretty much raised yourself.
Well, not a great period of time. I mean, a total of about 4 months was going on.
That seems like a great amount of time for a kid.
I guess. I was completely alone for no more than about 2 weeks at a time, at most. It was a very unstable kind of situation. But it's funny, I was just I was on tour, and I have occasionally run into groups of people who are about my age who grew up in similar circumstances, and they're like, yeah, that's really familiar. It's not that shocking. I think it's probably become more surprising over the years as people have become more helicopter-like in their parenting.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I did to get out of that was I applied to boarding school, and I went off to a place called Thatcher in the Ojai Valley. And I got myself into there to have some structure and to have a new family. And it's funny because I went back to my reunion recently, my 35th, and I asked one of the teachers there how it's different now. And he said, yeah, your experience would not happen anymore. And he said, in fact, now what happens is when a student gets into Thatcher, parents buy a house in Ojai so they can be close to their kids while their kids are in boarding school, which I find that to be nutty, but then again, people will find my experience nutty, so I probably shouldn't judge.
You know, I was curious, too. I mean, I'm curious about so many things about you and this book, but there's such a nice balance between scenes and narrative summary. And it seems to be especially problematic in memoir. And I'm curious if, with your fiction background, if that maybe influenced, if you brought over chops you acquired as a fiction writer to write memoir, or what you think about that.
What a perceptive question. Yes. I think that's another thing that was different in earlier drafts is that I tried to extend way beyond my fiction background and into something else. And that's fine, but really what makes it a story are those things you use in fiction where you're keeping a thing in scene, you're building characters, character conflict resolution, all that stuff where you can make sure that every scene changes things, and you always want to draw on that Henry James ending to Wings of a Dove, we shall never again be as we were, and make sure that every scene moves the story forward like that. And then foreshadowing and, having narrative judgments and things like that. But trying to think of it as a story in every single way except making stuff up. Was very helpful.
Hmm. I'd love to hear you read again. Could you do that?
Sure, I could. Hold on a second here. It's going to take me a minute.
Okay, and I will once again say you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Glenn David Gold. His memoir is I Will Be Complete, published by Knopf. And if you tuned in a little bit late, we will podcast this show within the next week or so. You can go to penonfire.com, or better yet, go to iTunes, subscribe to Writers on Writing. When we upload this show and when we upload any show, it will arrive in your inbox, your podcast in-file. So do that so you can hear the show from the beginning. Okay.
Okay. This is from right after what I just read.
Okay.
I can see why my mother liked my father. His family was a block of Russian Jews, a solid basalt steady heredity. They were simply Russian Jews as far back as there had been deer in that particular forest. Then the Jews moved to Chicago and opened a hardware store, and things got better. There was the sense that everyone was spreading out in similar directions, upward, onward. My great-grandfather had been a rabbi in a shtetl overrun by Cossacks. My grandfather ran G&M Hardware on 58th and Calumet. My uncles were lawyers. My father was an engineer. He traveled much of the year because he was making money for our future. That was a new matching pair of gifts for her, his easy confidence that there would be both money and a future. His family's trajectory of abundance was easier to hang on to than whatever Hydra's head of worry was on my mother's side. It must have been seductive for a while. When I was six, I asked my mother to explain the world map. What country fit where? It was hard to comprehend where England was in relationship to, say, Israel. When my mother pointed out their great distances from both us and from each other, I felt desolate. I had so wanted Israel and England to be next door. I couldn't explain why. "It's normal," she said. "When you're young, you think the world revolves around you. You'll start expanding outward. A young person thinks the world revolves around his country. When you're grown up, you'll see how the whole world fits together." "What about now?" I asked. "You're self-centered." "I thought about that. Is that good?" Only someone who is self-centered would ask that. She said this with love, I should mention. Around the same time, I'd added up a column of numbers faster than she had. And I'd said to her, "It's okay. Mommy's brain is slow." So that's what she was up against. Our development was called Harborview Hills. When we drove its gentle curves, it was in a new Mercedes 300 SEL on freshly poured streets that fanned out like the veins in palm fronds. When a road stubbed out in a cul-de-sac, its edges touched emptiness, scrub, raw earth. History only extended back 5 years or so. In the early 1960s in Corona del Mar, Orange County, California, the landscape was all fields and open rolling hills, and as the seasons turned, it was like money rained down upon the earth. Ranch houses and shopping centers for people like my family grew, and the more the money rained down, the larger the houses got. There was a middle school dropped into a local dirt field before the rest of the neighborhood had grown enough to be attached to it. One afternoon, the crew poured the school a sidewalk, and the next morning they found mountain lion tracks in the concrete. That was the end of the lions. No one saw a mountain lion in Corona del Mar again. I looked every day. I wanted there to be a mountain lion. I loved lions. We owned a vacant lot, the last lot in the neighborhood. I explored it for dandelions to blow apart, reeds to make whistles from. Imagine finding sacks of Morgan silver dollars smuggled from Carson City. I loved to stand on the lot and know we were holding on to it as an investment. My father told me we invested. When kids from the neighborhood tackled each other in the grass, I would find a reason to stand near them and say, "Well, you know, this lot is just an investment." There we go.
Thank you so much. Glenn David Gold reading from I Will Be Complete. Your description of people, it's not so much in this one, in this section, but throughout the book, there's so much great detailed description of people, of the characters in the book. And so I am wondering if that is something that is easy for you, or if you really kind of think of telling details, like how can I nail this character so that readers see him or her?
Well, it depends on the person. I mean, some people immediately walk in and announce who they are. You know, early on, my mom meets a con man, Peter Charming, and just from his name, you know. And he, every word out of his mouth was something that was almost iconic as far as being swindler talk. And that was easy to see even at age 10, so that was not a problem. You know, there's people with more layers to them who are a little harder to get. I would say you know, like when, later in the book, I meet a woman, Lindsay, who I thought was my soulmate at the time, and she was definitely someone who it was harder to get to because she had a lot of angles to her, and so that was a little harder to get.
I love the epigraph. A note on the accuracy of the text. My mother assures me none of this happened. That's kind of interesting. Now, is your mother still alive?
Yes, she is.
Did she read the book?
You know, this is beyond the covers of the book. You know, it's interesting. One of the things that happened is I had to find a place to stop in writing the book because, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like, you know, everything ended in 1995 there, but it was a point where I got to my own detachment and, you know, things continued, but I realized that there wasn't anything really new that I could bring to the pages with that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting writing about people that are still alive and writing, you know, such, you know, so in depth about family and
My dad is. Oh, no, my dad is, he's very much into the book. It took him a while, but he feels like I got it right, and he's pretty proud of it. It was definitely an adjustment period for him and for my stepmother and everything into letting it all hang out there. But they seem to be pretty good with it.
So is that a concern, though? Was that a concern because, again, because of your background with fiction, you know, with fiction, you can disguise the truth easily. In memoir, it's all there. And so, I don't know, as you're writing, were you concerned with how people would react? Or are you really able to keep those people out of your office, away from your desk when you're working?
Yeah, no, completely. I just completely suspended all that stuff until it was more closer to publication. And I did some editing, not so much for embarrassing details, but for fairness. Some of the very, very last edits I made, in fact, were after The Galley came out and went to some family members who... You know, they had their complaints about stuff, but I don't think I changed anything to please them. But I like looked at the information that was there and said, okay, I have not given the entire story still. Like, I don't think I'd given them as much of a voice as they deserved. I hadn't really told the whole story, but I'd maybe relied on some shorthand that was unfair.
So, say somebody said, you know, I want you to take me out of here. You know, don't write about me. What would you do?
Don't write about me?
Yeah. If say your dad or your mother or somebody said, you know, if you write about me, I'm going to disown you, never talk to you again. What would you do with that?
I mean, I've already been disowned, so that's not a problem. You know, that was always a bridge I would cross when I got to it, mm-hmm. but I never got to it. I always told myself I will deal with this when I act. You know, you can't, you never know how people are going to react to things completely. You know, I am very surprised and pleased by how most of the people in the book have responded so far. I know it's still early, but it's not something that I made contingency plans for. I always figured if I'm writing about nuanced characters, they're going to have a nuanced response, and so I just need to take it as it comes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, there's so many beginning memoir writers who are worried about how, you know, people close to them.
Well, yeah,
gonna react.
And I get it, and I had to completely turn that off. This might seem like a rationalization or a justification or something like that, but really, what it keeps coming down to me is what is the purpose of writing this book? And I'm pleased that zero people have read this book and thought I was out to get anybody. No, mm-hmm. 100% of people who have read this have looked at it, that have gotten back to me, have looked at it and gone, okay, there's a level of compassion for every person in here where you're giving everybody a turn at the mic rather than passing judgment on them. And with that in mind, I felt like that's okay. If I was trying to settle a score or shiv somebody, then that would be an issue. Mm. You know?
Well, and that relates back to something you said earlier, which was, I think right before the break, you said something like, if I don't ask anyone else to love me, it frees up narrative judgments. And, you know, I mean, that's a great line for memoir writers to remember, because then, you know, you are free. You're free to, you know, be whoever you were without having to generate love over that and to write honestly about your story.
And that's also a good lesson for not just for writing, but for everything else, too.
Yeah, for everything else. We are at the end of our time, and I was going to ask you about books and authors, and you mentioned a couple, Vivian Gornick and Jeffrey Wolfe and James Glick. And so I want to ask you about any sort of advice, writing advice that you maybe got early on or at some point that has stayed with you for the writers listening.
Yeah, strive toward adequacy. I have a tendency to try to bat things out of the park when I write, and that's never the way to do it. Always remember that I always remember the fact that revision is a major part of the writing and that you're not going to get it right the first time. And also, you have to find a balance between listening to your healthy critics and ignoring them. And it takes a while to hone that, because I basically ignored all of my critics at first because I've got a healthy egotism to me, and it took me a while to let in the voices that were actually trying to make the work better. But there's also, for a lot of writers, you have to learn how to ignore those critical voices, and that's a balance that only you are going to know when it's a productive one.
Yeah, good advice. Glenn, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show.
One book recommendation has zero to do with memoir. It's just that I cracked it open a couple of days ago, and I'm blown away by it, is Joy Williams' The Changeling. You know this book?
I don't know that book. I know Joy Williams, but not that book.
Yeah, Joy, right, of course you don't. Nobody does, because when it came out, there was a horrifically destructive New York Times review by a dude who didn't think she was doing feminism right back in 1978 when we let men dictate what women should do, which, of course, we're completely over now. but it literally was such a bad review of the book. As I understand the introduction to it, I sort of skimmed a little bit of the introduction because it was giving away plot points. But it seems that in the understanding of the book, it never even went into paperback. It just vanished because this guy savaged her so much. And I've started to read it, and the thing is, it's had a huge critical reappreciation in the last 40 years. But holy smokes, it's palm-sweatingly good. And I understand why it wasn't gotten at the time, is because it is so honest and so dark and unapologetically itself. It doesn't give you any handholds in some ways, but it's a great page-turning story. The observations are amazing, and I'll just say it starts with this. It starts with a 20-year-old woman sitting at a bar in Florida with a 2-month-old baby in her arms, and she's just pounding back gin and tonics with this 2-month-old kid in her arms. And, like, I can see why that upset people at the time, but when you understand why she's there and how it happened, it's riveting, and I'm really enjoying it.
I just wrote it down. I'm going to check it out, and I'm going to be in touch with you again about getting you down here to the speaker series. And again, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Likewise.
That was Glenn David Gold. His memoir is I Will Be Complete, published by Knopf. That's all we have for you today. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Next week, I believe Marie will be here with you. And in the meantime, remember to stay in the chair and get your writing done.